Good afternoon. Thanks for coming to this new or relatively new CSIS building despite the weather. And today we're very pleased to host Mr. Keisuke Sadamori. He's the Director for Energy Markets and Security at the International Energy Agency, which is based in Paris. And he's here to present the IEA's midterm coal market report. This report is part of the IEA's midterm report series, and it gives us an IEA forecast on coal markets for the coming 5 years, as well as an in-depth analysis of recent developments in global coal demand, supply, and trade. You already have his bio in front of you, but I will just give you a very brief version of it. Mr. Sadamori has been with IEA since 2012, and he monitors things other than coal, I mean global oil markets and also energy supply situations. Prior to joining IEA, he was with the Minister of Economy, Trade, and Industry of the Japanese government, and he has held various important posts, including his position as the executive assistant to the Prime Minister in 2011 when the Great East Japan earthquake and tsunami hit Japan, which, as you may know, triggered a Fukushima nuclear plant accident. And he has also been the Japanese representative to numerous international energy fora, including IEA governing board. So without further ado, please share your insights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nakano, for the nice introduction. And yes, my name is Sadamori. I'm from the IEA. I'm the director of the Energy Markets and Security at the IEA. So my responsibility is the emergency response, emergency preparedness, and the oil market monitoring, as well as the market analysis of gas, coal, power, and also recently the renewables, because renewable is no longer about the R&D story, but the actual deployment. And in some regions, they are already competing with the other fossil fuel sources without any subsidies. So that's what I do at the IEA. And also, it's nice to be back to this town because I used to work at the embassy in Washington, and that's more than 15 years ago, but I was here as the embassy staff from 1998 through 2001. So it's always a pleasure to come back to the city because this is where the action is in terms of the various policy issues. Now, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. So it is a pleasure for me to present the IEA's the medium-term coal market report in 2013. As explained by the moderator, so this is part of the medium-term market reports on oil, the gas, renewable, and coal. And we just launched this last month at the IEA. And now this is my first time to be presenting this at this Washington. And now, there's no denying the controversial reality of coal and its dominance of power generation worldwide. So no fuel draws the same ire, particularly for its polluting qualities both locally and in terms of the CO2 emissions. And yet no fuel is as responsible for powering the economic growth that has pulled billions out of energy poverty in the past decades. So as we look to the long term, we must ask what role coal has to play in the energy mix that we want to achieve because there will be a role. But without mitigating the polluting effects of coal, the pursuing business as usual will have an enormous tragic consequences. So before going to the specific findings of the medium-term coal market report 2013, which covers 5 years towards the 2018, let us take a look at the longer-term perspective based on the other flagship publication of the IEA, which is the World Energy Outlook 2013, which covers the year toward the 2035. Now, here is the world energy demand by fuel from 1980 to 2035, long outlook. And you can see easily that coal has grown fastest among the all fuel sources, not only fossils, in the first 10 years of this century. And this is mostly coming from the very rapid growth of China. And the future outlooks toward the 2035, that's in the dotted line. And this dotted line is based on the NPS new policy scenario, which is the central scenario of the World Energy Outlook, and which assumes the continuation of the existing policies and implementation of the policies that have been announced by the governments but are yet to be given effect. So in this NPS, coal will grow at a solid pace in the near future, but not faster than other fuel sources. But but it depends upon the which scenario in the wheel that you look at. So, for instance, the 450 ppm scenario, which is shown in the green bar, which shows that the 450 ppm scenario shows what it takes to set the energy system on track to have a 50% chance of keeping to 2 degrees Celsius in the long-term increase in the average global temperature. In this case, coal consumption must go down drastically, and only gas is allowed to grow among the fossil fuels. On the other hand, under the CPS, current policy scenario, which only takes into account the policy already exists, the coal will overtake oil and will continue to grow as the largest fuel source toward the 2035. So if we take the current policy scenario, the future outlook in the last slide would be different. So coal will overtake oil demand around the 2020, which would be similar to the projection in the medium-term the market reports. So I will show this to you later. So therefore, like it or not, the coal is here to stay for a long time to come. Another fundamental point about coal is that it is abundant and geopolitically secure. Even in the old sector, recently the high oil prices and the improvements in technologies like fracking have enabled the production levels formerly unseen. Overall, the remaining energy sources around the world will not constrain the projected energy demand in the foreseeable future. But among such fossil fuel sources, abundance of coal is outstanding. And as you know, the majority of coal is used for the power generation, and the iron steel production is the second largest use of coal, but that represents around 5% of coal use. And the outlook for the power generation in non-OECD countries, coal will continue to be the dominant generation fuel. Coal-fired plants are easily integrated into the existing power systems, and modern plants are very flexible, so providing affordable base load factor while backing up the variable renewable generation as well. So this is the about the World Energy Outlook, the entire global picture, but energy demand growth will be led by China and India and other Asian countries. And for the next decade, China will be the main driver of the global energy growth. And especially in the world of coal, China is dominant. China has half of both the global production and consumption of coal. So in China, the scale of coal in the economy is simply incomparable to fuels elsewhere. So replacing coal with gas in Chinese power generation would require twice the volume of all global LNG trade. So coal, therefore, continues to play an important role in the economic growth and energy security worldwide. And after 2020 to toward the 2035, it would be the India who would lead the global coal growth instead of China, which would drastically slow down. Now, I need to add that it is not only China and India. There is another publication by the IEA, which is the World Energy Outlook, Southeast Asia Energy Outlook. So this was released September, at the time in the margin of the ASEAN Energy Ministers meeting. And according to this outlook, if we continue the current path, the ASEAN's generation will generation mix will see a drastic change. So coal-fired power generation, which currently generates around 200 terawatt-hour, that's about 30% of the entire generation in 2011, will grow to more than 400 terawatt-hours in 2020 and more than 900 terawatt-hours in 2035. That would be the growth of 6% per year. And as a result, in 2035, the coal will take about half of the entire generation in that ASEAN region. On the other hand, the gas-fired generation will increase modestly by around 2% annually. So the gas power generation will lose its share from 44% in 2011 to 28% in 2035. I need to add that more than 70% of the coal power generation built under construction in this region are of subcritical type, which is the inefficiency, low efficiency type of the power generation plant. And that leads to the point that coal in its current form is simply unsustainable. So coal-fired heat and power generation is the biggest single source of carbon dioxide emissions resulting from fuel combustion today. And more than 3/5 of the rise in global CO2 emissions since 2000 is due to the burning of coal to produce the electricity and heat. And we should not overlook the health problem tied to the local pollution produced by the coal combustion. And as you can see in this slide, the majority of the new CO2 emissions are coming from the non-OECD countries. And even on an accumulated basis, since the year 1900, non-OECD would reach almost the same level as the OECD countries in 2035. Even though we have known how to build efficient, the kind of a very high efficiency coal-fired power plant since the 1960s, most of the coal plants built since then, and a large proportion of ones are being developed today, in particular in the non-OECD areas, are of that inefficient subcritical kind. If these subcritical plants under development in India and ASEAN states, including the Indonesia, were completed with the latest existing technology, it would save as much CO2 as would be saved by all the wind turbines in Europe. So when it comes to the sustainable energy profile, we are simply off track, and the coal in its current form is the prime culprit. Yet with coal set to remain an integral part of our energy mix for the decades to come, the challenge is to make it cleaner and more efficient. So what I stated above is the long-term perspective as a background to this medium-term coal market report. And now let me move on to the findings of the medium-term coal market report 2013. We released this in December last year. So this is a book. Now, this slide serves to underline the point that not only coal is here to stay, but coal demand growth is also not showing any signs of stopping. Over the next 5 years, additional coal production capacity of 500,000 tons per annum will be added worldwide each day. And that will be necessary to meet the worldwide demand increase of around 2.3% per year on average until 2018. Every year, the coal continued to grow more than oil and gas. So in 2012, China and the United States had abnormally low coal consumption. And I will come back to this point later in the presentation, but even with this abnormal drop in the growth in China and in the United States, the coal grew more than oil and gas. If nothing changes, coal will catch up with oil as the world's biggest primary energy source in the foreseeable future, and nobody can be surprised in accordance with the recent trends. And in 2012, China surpassed the rest of the world in coal consumption, and this is in energy terms, not in terms of physical tons. And what is remarkable is that the growth in China is projected to be much lower than it used to be. So we assume strong economic growth in China. However, our projections for the Chinese coal growth are much lower, and that's 2.6% per year on average. And this gap comes from the efficiency both in the production and consumption of the electricity, diversification away from coal in non-power sector all around the economy, and the rebalancing to a less coal-intensive economy. Now, on the other hand, the coal conversion emerges as a demand driver with potential to increase the coal demand. And I will also come back to this point later. And so this is what happened in China in 2012. So coal demand growth in China in 2012 was only 4.7%, and that's the second lowest in the decade. Comparing the historical trends with the 2012, we noticed that the three factors that could explain the low coal demand growth in China of 2012. And the first, the GDP growth was 7.8% in 2012. And that's lower than the average in the with the past trend. Over the last decade, China has grown over 10% per year on average. Second, the elasticity of power in relation to the GDP was 0.74. And this is the third lowest level in the decade with an average of 1.1. So that's the, was it a yellow or green? I don't know, I mean. And so the third, in 2012, the hydro production in China was 23% higher than in 2011. So almost all the extra hydro production resulted in less coal power generation. This is the OECD, the coal demand outlook. So if we turn to the OECD outlook to the 2018, the general trend is flat. But the picture at the regional level is more nuanced. So in the United States, which is the blue line, the demand will largely depend on the coal and gas price evolution. So another important factor is the retirement of the coal-fired plants, and which will be more important in 2015 due to the mercury and air toxic standards taking effect in January at the beginning of 2016. In Europe, which is a red line, the coal, gas, and CO2 prices are expected to continue to give a cost-competitive advantage to coal over gas. But we consider that most of the gas to coal switching has already occurred, and the slow economic growth and more renewables will drive out the thermal generation production. So significant new coal capacity are expected in Germany and Netherlands, but there will be also be the significant retirements in both countries and in others, especially in the United Kingdom. And therefore, we don't believe that the coal will continue to grow in Europe. It will finally decline slowly. But in Asia, high gas prices and concerns about the nuclear power generation plant will make the coal plants run at the high load factors, so we expect solid growth in OECD Asia, Japan and Korea. All in all, the OECD coal demand in 2018 is forecast to be about the same as it was in 2012. So we saw in the last slide that in OECD countries, growth in Asia offsets declines in Europe and US. And here we see the most of the coal demand growth comes from Asia, also in the non-OECD countries. So this is moving trade and the center of gravity towards east, which impact on the price setting as well. Now, let us see, but who is more coal dependent? And if we take a look at the coal consumption on a per capita basis for the power generation, we might be surprised to see how per capita consumption in places like Australia, United States, and Germany is bigger than in China. And actually, China and Denmark's per capita coal consumption are quite close. And on the other hand, we can also see that the low level of per capita consumption in countries considered as the coal places like India and Indonesia. Now, but it is not only in Germany and Denmark that depend on coal in Europe. With cost advantage of coal over gas, as I said, the European countries, Germany, Spain, UK, increased the coal consumption in the last few years. Some call it the golden age of coal in Europe. But that cost advantage of coal in Europe is nothing comparable to the cost advantage of coal in Asia region. So this slide shows the price of coal, and that's in dark blue, the lower line, and gas, that's in red, the higher line. And the purple bars indicate the CO2 prices necessary to make gas as competitive as coal, taking into account only the variable costs. Because given that the new investment decisions cannot materialize within our outlook, you know, medium-term outlook period, we do not consider the capital costs for this comparison. So this is purely about the fuel switching in short term. If we consider the capex factors, then the price would be lower, but still significant. And it is evident that why coal plants will work at high load factors in Japan and Korea. And this break-even carbon cost, so to say, is currently around 140 or 150 US dollar per ton. And you know that the carbon prices in Europe right now is less than 5 euros, or in the US dollars, that'll be $7 probably per ton of the CO2. So you can see that this $150 per ton is something not possible in the foreseeable future. And in order to give the scale of how this impacts on the electricity prices, this $150 per ton would translate to around $50 per megawatt hour, or 5 cents per kilowatt hour for gas, and $125 per megawatt hour, or 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour for coal. So you can see that the kind of a level of impact of this level of carbon pricing comes in order to make the coal and gas the equally competitive. Now, let me talk about a little bit about the coal trade, and that's growing faster but moving east. And in this map, the countries in blue, they are the exporters, and the green countries are some of the significant the importers. And what this chart shows are projections for the thermal coal trade in 2018. So the Pacific Basin has two biggest exporters, as you know, the Indonesia and Australia, as well as the biggest importers, China, Japan, India, Korea, and Taiwan. Therefore, it concentrates most of the seaborne trade with increasing share. In the Atlantic Basin, on the left-hand side, Colombia and the United States are the main exporters, with European receiving most of the coal. South Africa and Russia, they are the kind of a swing suppliers, and increasing their sales to the Pacific Basin. So especially countries like South Africa, they used to ship most of their coal to the European countries, but now it's more and more moving toward the Pacific side, providing even to the countries like Japan. So those thermal coal trade continues to move east, and that would have a kind of impact on the price setting in the global trade. On the supply side, the main expansions take place in Indonesia and the Australia. About the prices, we see in this chart how prices have shown a declining trend in both steam and metallurgical coal. Steam coal prices, for example, declined from over $120 per ton to below $80 per ton, and that's a 35% decline. So both steam and metallurgical coal prices are in the low part of the traditional boom and bust cycle, and mostly coming from the current oversupply. The chart at the bottom, I'm sorry, it's a kind of small one. So this one shows how the fossil fuel prices have evolved since 2005. And we can see that the oil prices are now 2.5 times what they used to be in 2005. And gas prices in Europe are twice what they used to be. And coal prices are almost the same as the 2005 levels. And of course, this story would not be complete without the gas prices in US, and that's in red, and which is a lot lower compared with the 2005. So although the coal demand is not so price elastic in some regions of the world, but it is obvious that the low prices would mean, would lead to the higher demand of coal. Now, we often hear that the shale gas production in the United States is driving coal prices down in Europe and worldwide. And yeah, indeed, the shale gas was one of the reasons, but not the only one. For instance, the US winter of 2012 was mildest one in decades, so it's a lot warmer than this year, obviously, and leading to the lower gas demand for the heating and thermal generation. So this caused the high gas inventories in spring 2012, with Henry Hub gas prices at the time breaking the level of $2 per million BTU. And this is a very well-known story, especially in the United States. And this decreased coal consumption, that's equivalent to the around the 200 terawatt-hour switch from coal to gas from 2011 to 2012. The thermal coal exports from the United States increased. But if we put this in perspective, we see that the expansions occurred in all those big countries, especially Indonesia and Australia. So therefore, we need to consider that the U.S. only was only a kind of a part of the current oversupply. Now, the one point about the United States is that the picture of what happened in the United States in 2012 is not complete if we do not mention this coal-fired plants retirement. Over 10 gigawatt in 2012, mostly driven by the EPA regulations, were decommissioned. And even if the retired coal power plants are usually the old and efficient ones, and hence with low load factors, there's an impact on the coal demand, of course. And as mentioned before, we expect the big retirements again in 2015 as the new standard on the mercury and air level is enforced since the 1st of January in 2016. There's a kind of misconception on the U.S. coal that all coal which was not consumed in the United States was simply exported to Europe. In this chart, I'm sorry, it's a bit hard to see, but in this chart we can see that the coking coal exports were flat in 2011 and 2012. That's a red part, almost the same height. And only one quarter of the 100 million tons of decrease in coal demand in the United States was exported. So out of 100 less coal demand in the United States, around 26 million tons, so about a quarter, were exported. And that was mainly to the Europe, sure. So now, so that's shown in the in this change of the thermal coal exports. So we have seen a little bit of increase, but that's not all. So so the coal not used in the United States did not go to Europe. So the question is, where did it go? And we have seen the various the newspaper reports about this thing is that, well, it's actually the U.S. coal, so this is the answer. I mean, the industry had to face the overcapacity and had to reduce the production. So they are still remaining under the ground. So so they had to reduce production by around 70 million tons, as we saw in the last slide. So this has produced a significant loss of jobs, especially in regions like Kentucky or West Virginia. So the job creation in shale gas has implications in other sectors. Of course, this is part of the economy, but I think that we should be aware of this. And the coal market in the United States is rather complex, with a majority of long-term contracts and sophisticated logistics. But in a simple analysis, we see that the Central Appalachian and the Powder River Basin accounted for most of the decline. Whereas it seems logical that Central Appalachian regions, probably the highest cost region in the United States, suffered a big cut, we think that the Powder River Basin, the lowest cost coal in the United States, is more related to some of the retirements shown in a few slides ago. So without the desulfurication units and hence consuming the low sulfur coal from Powder River Basin. So they're mostly decommissioned and retired. So that's the reason why the Powder River Basin coal has been hit in recent years. And this is about the Chinese the coal conversion. So we used to consider that the coal to liquid and coal to gas kind of conversion has been considered, you know, they were non-economical. But nevertheless, there are a few considerations that we should take into account now. And first, of course, that the coal to liquid and coal to gas conversion is expensive, but now we are seeing the very high prices of oil and gas, especially in the Asian region. Secondly, the coal to gas or the coal to liquids processes, that they are ideal for the stranded coal in China especially. That is the coal that is low cost, but low quality and far from the demand centers. And third, especially the coal to gas conversion with pipeline networks, if it works, could address the problem of rail transport of coal in China. So during the next 5 years, the coal gasification will contribute more to the China's gas supply than shale gas. While there are many uncertainties about these technologies, the potential scale of projects in China involving coal to produce the synthetic natural gas and synthetic liquid is enormous. So if this were to become reality, it would mark not just an important development of coal markets, but would also imply the revisions to the gas and oil market outlooks. So thank you very much for your patience. So this is a wrap-up. So coal demand will grow at 2.3% per year on average to reach almost 9 billion tons in 2018. And let me remind you that in 2000, global coal demand was less than 4.8 billion tons. So it's a huge rapid increase. And we believe that the policies of the new government in China will slow coal demand growth, but we do not project peak coal in China in our outlook period. And the OECD coal demand will be basically flat, as Japan and Korea will offset declines in other OECD economies. Indonesia and Australia will lead export growth, and Australia has increased production costs recently, but it's still competitive. And finally, after some years of uncertainty, it seems that the coal conversion in China is taking off, but its scale will depend on the environmental and other issues. So thank you very much for your patience, and so that's it from me. And I'll be happy to field any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Just a quick question before I open the floor to more of a general questions. The second point about the peak, the Chinese demand peak, Mr. Sadamori, so you said that through 2018, you don't expect it. In the longer version or the WEO 2014, do you discuss when that may happen? When before 2035 that may happen, or would it be beyond the horizon?
That's a valid question, and because this is about the medium-term market reports, so we do not. So this is not based on the scenario analysis. Okay. While in case WEO, so it depends. I mean, if we take the more kind of the sustainable type of scenarios, then Chinese coal demand must decrease. But so I have to say that it depends on the scenarios, and it all comes down to the individual the climate change and the energy policies that the individual country would have. Yeah, thank you.
So now I invite anyone here to. Ask questions. And just a ground rule, if you could please identify yourself and let us know who you're with, and then ask the question, a formal question. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sure.
My name is John. I work for Whitestone Capital, and we trade commodities. And I have a question about India coal. As you well know, they've set quite ambitious goals to import more and more coal over the years. They're getting most of their coal from Richards Bay and Newcastle and Kalimantan. Do you think that if coal production there were to max out at some point and they had to still hit targets, would they start calling up more sources in the U.S. to import from other sources?
So your question about the Indian increase of imports from which country? So
from the Asia-Pacific region plus South Africa. If they have to get, if they have to keep getting more and they're not hitting their targets from their current supply, do you think they'll look to the U.S. and maybe Colombia or Russia to meet those demands?
Yeah. I think it depends. I think it depends. There's no doubt that the India will increase the coal imports, and soon, instead of China, India will be the biggest, especially the biggest importer of coal in overseas, you know, the coal. And from which country, I think it depends. I can only say that there are enormous resources abound in the ASEAN region. You know, Indonesia still has a lot of capacity, while Australia has a lot of coal, and South Africa, they are the real swing supplier, and now increasing the supply, their supply to the coal. So, but because the coal has a, unlike LNG, the coal is has a very flexible, liberal, you know, the trading regime due to its character. So if especially the Colombian coal can be competitive in price terms, even if we add the kind of extra transport cost, then they can be. But I would say that it all depends upon the market conditions. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, Jane, thanks for hosting all of us. My name is Meredith Miller. I'm from the National Bureau of Asian Research. And thank you very much for the very interesting presentation. I was wondering if you could repeat the statistic you offered about what kind of gains would be available from the implementation of ultra-supercritical or supercritical power plants in planned projects in Indonesia and other developing countries, non-OECD countries in Asia. And secondly, if you've done any analysis of what kind of a carbon price would make the use of that technology more competitive. Thank you.
What I said in my presentation was that all those subcritical plants under development in India and in ASEAN states, including Indonesia, were completed with the latest existing technologies, so super ultra critical type of high efficiency coal power generation plants, it would save as much CO2 as would be saved by all the wind turbines in Europe. So that's what I stated. But I think it's a real kind of a practical and realistic ways in order to reduce the CO2 emissions in these countries, because they'll be using coal anyway. So the improving the efficiency, because that's possible with existing technologies. So I think that that's a real the effective way to do it. And what was the second question?
Can you look at what kind of a carbon price would be to incentivize greater use of technology?
Well, I've been using this the carbon pricing issues in terms of the comparison of the gas and coal. So in terms of increasing the efficiency increases, I think it can be done even without the carbon pricing per se, because that would reduce the consumption of the coal if they can really increase the level of efficiency of those coal power generation plants. So it's a kind of a comparison between the larger CapEx, capital cost at the outset, or the long-term benefits out of the improved efficiency. So I don't think that the even without the carbon pricing, if we can come up with a kind of the good support to the initial investment phase, then I think that should be possible, because it pays in the longer term. Yeah. But of course, the carbon pricing should help. I mean, of course. But I think it's a rather relative term. I'm sorry, I have not done any that kind of a specific calculations, but yeah. Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you very much. This has been very important.
For the microphone, please.
If you could wait, since we're taping or doing a live stream or whatever it's called, since I'm kind of technically challenged, but if you can wait for the microphone, that would be a great help.
Sure. Sorry about that. Brian Andrews with the Asia Group. Your presentation noted that the U.S. regulatory environment is having some impact on U.S. coal demand, particularly with the retirement of coal-powered electricity production. I was wondering if you have a perspective or view on some of the U.S. changes announced last year where they would be withholding support on IFI financing for coal power projects internationally. Do you expect that that policy change will have any impact on global coal consumption or demand? Or is this something you haven't really paid attention to, or it's just, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a drop in the bucket?
So you're talking, your question is about the kind of about the U.S. Policy changes and the kind of impact coming from that to the international, the right. deployment
well,
of the carbon.
And specifically the U.S. not supporting IFI financing of coal.
I see. I guess that would include the World Bank's policy, multilateral lending institutions policy against the coal use. Well, thank you. Thank you for your question. Well, I would say that in terms of the direct impact, if we take a look at how the coal projects are financed, if you take a look at the whole supply chain of coal from the production to the consumption, including the power generation plants. We consider that the majority, most of the financing is coming from the private sector. And I'm not sure, but I understand that it would be something like a 5% is provided by that public multilateral financing institutions. So I would say that in terms of the direct financing impact, we don't consider that to be a kind of to have a serious impact on it. But in terms of the indirect effect, I'm not sure. I mean, but I would say that what is important is that we really need to make sure that the efficiency improvement investment should take place in those developing countries, including the Asia, Southeast Asia, and India, and China. Otherwise, we may lose the window of opportunities for reducing the CO2 emissions in a practical and realistic way. So I think that's something that we need to ensure, and that's part of the responsibility of the developed economies. Thank you.
If I can add a quick follow-up question to that excellent question. So from what I understand, the ADB has, the World Bank has pretty much followed the U.S. Treasury Department guidance, or however you call it, on the financing. From what I understand, ADB has not adopted that line of thinking. To the extent you're comfortable, if you could share with me what sort of discussions you might be aware of with among the Asian countries, because I think coal, as you eloquently explained, I mean, it is still a very big player in the Asian energy economy. So thanks.
I'm not a real expert on this multilateral lending institution, so I guess that there would be some others who knows better than I do. But my understanding is that in the very discussion at the ADB, especially those the Asian member countries' view is somewhat different from that of the United States. So they're more positive about ensuring the investment money flow to the Asian the coal power generation plants. So that's as far as I know in general. But I'm not sure about the very specific the policies of them. Thank you. But I also would like to point out that it's not only about the multilateral lending institutions, but we also have the bilateral the credit support institutions in various the countries. Yeah.
Yes.
Ken Meyer, Court, World Docs. One of the trends over the last decade, at least, with regard to oil is the increasing cost of producing oil in terms of the energy return for energy invested. which is reflected in the price per barrel. If it was still $30 a barrel, nobody would be practicing hydraulic fracturing or probably deep water drilling or mining tar sands. With regard to coal, is it not only cheap, but for the foreseeable, I mean, not only abundant, but for the foreseeable future, cheap to produce?
At least in the this medium-term outlook, I mean, as far as we can see, we do not expect the coal costs to increase drastically because they're so abundant and they still have the resources that can be easily exploited. So I understand that the situation is rather different from the situation of oil, where they have to go all the way to the Arctic Sea or the very deep sea resources or the fracking. So I think the coal is not, the days that the coal will move into that kind of a high cost stage is very far, yeah.
I'm Bob Hershey, I'm a consultant. Could you tell us some more about coal conversion, of how much would be to synthetic natural gas and how much to oil? What kind of demand we're talking
about? First of all, I would have to say that it depends. I mean, we're not so sure how much of the project can be actually be implemented because there's a lot of uncertainties as to the environmental impacts. You know, when I first heard that the coal to gas conversion may take place, I thought that it's a good news. I mean, because gas is a lot more cleaner. But the coal to gas conversion in being considered in China actually would produce more CO2 because that would be less efficient than burning coal itself. So of course they would do that in order to improve their handling of the energy sources because the gas would be a lot easier to use in some occasions, we have not. There'll be more of the environmental impacts coming from that. So it all depends upon how the Chinese regulatory authorities would respond to that. And also, in order for the coal to gas, for instance, to work, there needs to be an access to the pipeline. So, as you know, China also has in the process of developing the gas networks in their countries. So it also depends on the transport logistics of that. And what I'm looking at is, what was the size of the in this very report? I'm sorry. Let me come back to you later because there's an assumption in this in certain point, but that's not huge. Yeah, but I think that. We are seeing the kind of the rise in this technology in China, and that could be kind of the major factor in the coal demand. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. My name is Tom Cutler. I'm an independent consultant. So I have a question about coal trade. I noticed in one of your charts you showed the drop in production from the Powder River Basin, which is a very large economic resource for coal in the U.S., and in another chart you had a very thin line coming out of the Pacific Northwest for U.S. coal exports to Asia. So my question is, do you have any perspective on the prospects for increased coal exports from the Northwest U.S. to Asian markets? And how might that compete with U.S. coal exports out of the Gulf through the Panama Canal to Asian markets?
I would say that the Powder River Basin has a very cheap. I think that's one of the cheapest the coal that can be exploited in the United States. But I also understand, there's the problem of the transport cost and the export infrastructures with that Powder River Basin. Unlike the Appalachian coal, which has a kind of a long years of tradition and very endowed export facilities. So it all depends upon the how those infrastructure can be developed and also how the cost would will turn out to be. I mean, so it's so it's up to the market. So we're not sure how the resource will actually be exported. So that's I would have to say that depends on the market conditions. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your question.
Anyone else? Oh. Yeah, sure. Okay. Round two.
Isn't pet coke competitive with coal for certain pet coke? Petroleum coke? Isn't that competitive with coal for certain applications? And isn't China increasing their import of pet coke? And aren't we increasing our production of pet coke? I forget exactly why. It's got something to do with light oil versus heavy oil.
I'm sorry, I don't think I have the data with this data report, so. I don't think I have any specific answer to that question. I'm sorry.
Well,
yeah.
Is it competitive with coal for certain applications? And it's a lot more polluting, isn't it?
Yeah. It could be cost competitive, but it all depends upon the various the environmental regulations, and so it depends on the circumstances, I guess. Yeah.
So, anyone else? So I guess I get to ask one last. Oh,
sure. Guy Caruso, CSIS. Hey, Suki, I know the Chinese have been somewhat reluctant to partner up with IEA. You know, certainly at the level of membership, but they are very active in things like technology. Is that true for the coal technology? Have the Chinese been active participants in cooperating with our member, using the term R as a IEA.
Well, thank you very much for the question, and I'm really happy to see that you call the IEA as we our. So that's it's nice.
8 years.
Yeah. Yes. I think there's some multiple factors around the relationship between the IEA and China, and of course, first of all, the IEA started in the 1970s, as a kind of the importers' alliance against the physical disruption of the oil imports, and at that time IEA was created under the framework of the OECD. So we have the OECD members as the IEA members, not exactly the same, but basically. And during the time, the OECD or IEA members consumed around 3/4 of global oil. So that was. That was appropriate, but now we are seeing the more and more the energy demand coming from the non-OECD countries now, and from last year to this year, we'll see that the non-OECD oil demand will overtake the OECD demand. So that means that the IEA has only half of global oil consumption, and that will lead to the question of whether our emergency response regime is effective in case of physical disruption. So that leads to that forces us to work more with the non-member countries. And right now we are working on the initiative called the association. So we are trying to create a kind of category of association partners and to work with the IEA more before becoming a members. And the China is of course an important partner in that respect, and so we are doing a lot of work projects with China. In terms of the energy security, we think that the working with the China is very important, but that's not only about oil, but the coal, particularly, gas, because they are interested in how they can modernize their gas market, so we are willing to contribute to China in that respect, and also the various climate change energy efficiency technologies as well. So, we think that we'd like to do more, work more with China. And for instance, in case of the coal, for instance, we have what we call the CIAB, Coal Industry Advisory Board, and there are some major Chinese, the coal power generation companies, the coal companies that are member to the CIAB. So, on a private sector basis, we already have they started to work with China. So all in all, we would like to see more of cooperation with China, but it requires a lot of work ahead of us. So first of all, we need to build more confidence with each other. So so I'm willing to work whatever cooperative project with China in that respect. Thank you very much for your question. Yeah.
Well, it's time. So please join me in thanking Sada Mori-san for his excellent presentation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thanks again for coming all the way here, despite the freezing sub-zero Celsius temperature. And stay warm.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.